Our next speaker is Madison Perry of the Adam Smith Institute in London. He was in this country. He'd been a distinguished visiting professor of philosophy at Hillsdale College in the late 70s. He formed the Adam Smith Institute. His books include Privatization in Theory and Practice and Blueprint for a New Revolution. He's spoken all over the world on privatization, in even more countries, I think, than for longtime Philadelphia Society members, and even more countries than are usually represented at the Sunday morning discussion of foreign policy around the world. Dr. Perry.
Thank you very much indeed, Chairman. As you say, I am president of the Adam Smith Institute. I should explain this position is slightly less important than that of British Prime Minister. It is, however, considerably more secure than the position of the British Prime Minister. The Adam Smith Institute is, of course, a think tank. Many on the left think it went septic many years ago. I will answer very quickly the three questions everyone asks. How many people work there? And the answer is about half. How is it funded? Inadequately. What is our relationship with monarchy? Well, we have absolutely none at all. I think we're the only people in Britain who've had no kind of affair with any member of the royal family. We do, however, have a relationship with government, and it's one founded on trust and understanding. We don't trust them. They don't understand us. This week is, for me, a particularly significant anniversary because it was 20 years ago this week that Don Lipsett first invited me, and I attended and spoke to my very first meeting of the Philadelphia Society, then meeting in Chicago. And I remember some elements of the speech I gave. I told the delegates of this new British leader of the Conservative Party, who'd just been elected a couple of months earlier, and of all the things we were going to do in Britain. We were going to sell the public houses at huge discounts to their sitting tenants. We were going to privatize the state industries and then the state utilities with a share allocation for the workers in order to get them to support this radical measure. We were going to undermine the power of union leaders, not by trying to confiscate it, as Edward Heath had done unsuccessfully, but by distributing it downwards to the workers, so they would have the right to ballot before strike action, the right to a postal ballot to select their leaders, instead of intimidating mass meetings at workplace. And I outlined to enthusiastic, if somewhat skeptical, Philadelphia Society audience, and it all seems so long ago. I would add only a short epilogue to that. Been there, seen that, done that. Can I be heard at the back? Please raise your hands if you can't hear me. Professor Butterfield, the Master of Trinity College, Cambridge, regularly started every lecture at the beginning of the year by asking, "Can everybody hear me?" Until one student put his hand up and said, "Sir, I can hear you, but I'll gladly change places if there's anyone who can't." Well, in addition to the program that I outlined 20 years ago, we also have introduced things that we weren't even planning to do at the time, like making it compulsory for all local governments in Britain to seek private contractors to perform city work, like introducing school choice right across the nation. Indeed, after the next election, we plan to make that compulsory too, that all schools will become charter schools, funded by their ability to attract students. And of course, we've introduced an internal market into our National Health Service. And indeed, as we sit here today, the Labour Party has been meeting in Britain to abandon Clause 4 of its constitution, which commits it to socialism. That is happening on this very day. So we've come quite a long way, and now here we are 20 years later with our fingers curling gently round the edge of the biggest prize of all, that is the welfare state. As John Blundell said, its costs have never been controlled, not even under Margaret Thatcher. The welfare state in Britain accounts for 40% of all of our spending. It is larger than the amount we spend on education, health, and defence, all added together. It costs every working person $20 every single day to support. This is in a country where we don't earn quite as much as you do. $20 is quite a slice out of the average British wage. And the other thing is, of course, it's a system characterized by fraud. I was asked to write an article for The Spectator about the welfare state, and I did some research and was absolutely astounded to discover that everybody is defrauding the welfare state. Entire housing estates, I did not meet a single person out of several hundreds who was not defrauding the welfare state in some way. I rapidly revised upwards. The Treasury estimate of fraud is about, I think, £7 million a year, or say about $11 million. I rapidly formed the view that it's actually probably about $30 million a year in fraud alone. The problem, of course, as John Blundell has outlined, is that the public choice analysis is against us. Every single group that's receiving a benefit values that benefit, and the saving to the rest of us of cutting that particular benefit is not large. No one is ever going to demonstrate to cut welfare state benefits. People will always demonstrate to keep welfare state benefits. This is not a good formula for any politician to take on. And Thatcher was accused of vicious and savage cuts, and in fact, under her, welfare benefits rose in real terms, welfare spending in real terms, every single year. As an example of just how difficult this is, I ask you to look at our least efficient welfare benefit in Britain. It's called child allowance, and you get it by having a child, and it's paid automatically into your bank account. You don't even have to claim it. So it is 100% reaching those who qualify. The take-up rate, we say, is 100%. Two-thirds of it goes to the richest two-thirds of people living in Britain. The Princess of Wales gets child benefit, for example. It is, in other words, not targeted at all. Now, you'd think that this was a benefit that you could at least try to do something about. And the last government before this one did indeed embark upon a vicious and cruel, heartless policy of freezing child benefit. That is, letting inflation gradually erode its value in real terms. John Major was forced to drop that policy at the last election. The Tory ladies in the shires, in the county seats of Britain, demanded of their members of Parliament that John Major's government had to pledge itself to restoring the real value of this child benefit. They actually liked having the money. It paid their tennis club fees. They didn't see why they should go without. After all, they paid their taxes. And so I simply mentioned that even what one would have thought was the least defensible benefit, we couldn't even, never mind reducing it, we couldn't even hold its spending steady. So the moral of this, we take it to be that you can't actually do it, that it is, in a democracy, politically impossible to reduce welfare spending. Well, hence we come to the counterpart of public choice theory. Can you creatively devise policies which will persuade people that they have more advantage in the new than they had in the old? And so instead of confiscating their benefits, you get them to trade their benefits. This, after all, was the secret of privatization. We took on board every single group who could have opposed it. The management, the civil service people who ran these state industries became the new board of directors. The workers became shareholders with half-price shares. The customers were given special allocations and bonuses if they held on to their shares. And then we systematically examined every single group with a stake in the process of state industries and gave them more through the act of privatization. Well, can one do this with the welfare state? I concede with John Blundell that this is not going to be easy. But life would be no fun if it were easy. And we are embarking in Britain upon the task, just starting the process now, which at the end of a long road will result in the destruction of the welfare state. The shape of reform is beginning to emerge. We have to solve not only the problem of the interest groups, the Tory ladies in the shires who like their tennis club money. We also have to solve a very technical problem, which is that our welfare system is unfunded, meaning that although we pretend that people are paying money in order to pay Social Security in their retirement, it's a lie. The money that they pay today is spent today on present claimants. There is no fund at all. Now this creates, it's a pay-as-you-go system, we say, or if we're being more accurate, a chain letter. The only reason you have for joining now, apart from compulsion, is the belief that someone will be an even bigger mug than you were in 40 years' time. But you do see the problem it raises. If we're going to replace it by a funded system, in which people insure themselves, one generation is going to have to pay twice. They're going to have to pay into the fund that will provide for their own retirement and welfare needs, and they're also going to have to continue to pay to meet today's unfunded claimants. And that has been the central problem that has made the welfare state the most difficult of all of the reforms we've undertaken. There will never be, I predict, a bill introduced in Britain to end the welfare state. There will be no apocalyptic clash when we fight head-on, all out, and either we win or they win. No, it is going to be a long march, benefit by benefit, through the entire system. We're going to do it slowly, and we're going to do it piecemeal, and we're going to do it successfully. We already have a model. In the 1980s, we passed legislation allowing people to opt out of the state earnings-related pension scheme. In Britain, we have two state pension schemes. There is one basic Social Security, which everybody gets, and there is an earnings-related scheme. And we allowed people to opt out of that and gave them a small tax concession for doing so. And very rapidly, more than half of them left it. And it's now a very small rump left in that system. So we're going to use this as the model. And we're even now in the process of restructuring the welfare benefits one by one so that they match counterparts which are already offered in the private sector. And then the next step is to allow people one by one to opt out of the state benefit, provided they can show that they have cover in the private sector instead. First, we will start with what is called a job seeker's assurance, unemployment assurance, and then we move on to the basic pension or Social Security. How do we solve the problem of an unfunded system and avoiding a generation having to pay twice? We solve it because the state is inefficient. For an 18-year-old joining work in Britain today, we ask the question, what would they have to pay to a private system, to a private insurer, to get the same benefits that the state promises to give them in Social Security when they reach the age of 65? The answer is, they'd have to pay 20% of what they pay into the state. Now that leaves a huge gap with which we can fund down the existing claimants. We can indeed securitize that and sell it forward if we want to establish a capital fund. But the point is, the superior efficiency of the private sector gives us a big margin to play with. So we don't have to excuse them all of their payment to the state to get them to go private. Some of it will be enough, and with the rest, we can meet existing obligations. Well, fundamentally, this means that the British welfare state will have to abandon universality. It's going to let everyone seek a better deal outside, and it's going to leave the state system as a shell for those for whom no other option is available. And then, when we're left with that shell, we'll privatize the administration of even that. And so, the upshot is that the welfare state, which was started in post-war Britain by Lord Beveridge with the most noble aspirations, it was designed to provide for everyone a humane, caring, and compassionate society, and which turned into probably the most sociopathic instrument ever devised by man. It has destroyed family responsibility, it has destroyed self-reliance, it has destroyed individual aspiration, it has created a permanent ghetto class of people dependent on the state and trapped in that poverty. This was us trying to do good, by the way. And so the challenge of the welfare state is one I think we're about to meet. The challenge is, of course, to get rid of it.